I think the first step is trying to understand what exactly are we trying to achieve? What is the job to be done or jobs to be done? Who is involved and who benefits? And what level of comfort do they have with generative AI as it relates to the way they're currently doing whatever it is they're doing versus what they could be doing? And what's the risk profile of doing it differently?
AI, everyone's talking about it. You see it everywhere you go. But what does it mean? How can we use it? And where is technology actually going? Today on Winning with Data, I'm talking to Alec Coughlin, who is really at the forefront in a senior role with an award-winning AI company, but he's also been researching and leveraging this technology for as long as anyone that I know. He's recently launched AI with Alec, and I'm here to learn all about what he will teach us on that. Alec, welcome to the show.
Hey, appreciate it, Jake. Always a pleasure. I'm excited to talk about this stuff. As you said, I've been geeking out on it for a long time, and all of a sudden you wake up one day, November 30th, and the world changes, and here we are.
A lot of veterans in this space, when asked, will refer to the fact that large language models have been around for a while, and text-based queries have too. What's changed? What's new? And why should we care?
I think it's such a fair and good question. I think that the best way to answer that question is just to give you an example. The reason I always talk about November 30th, as we all know, is that's when ChatGPT burst onto the scene. And, you know, no one needs to kind of run through the numbers of how quickly it's been embraced and 100 million users and all these things. That's all the payoff. But I think to make it real, the reason why this stuff is so important is that the CEOs of the largest companies in the world are interacting with ChatGPT, you know, as well as interacting with their kids, grandkids, and whomever else in their universe personally, that's enabling, you know, him or her to experience the magic and the power of generative AI in a real way, right? Not like a PowerPoint way or like a, you know, whatever. And so what that does is that transforms their native understanding of how powerful the technology is and how important it is to understand where can we introduce these types of technologies and AI systems to improve, you know, people, process, technology, internal, external, you know, go down the list, right? Jump in with the corporate strategy, you know, lingo, bingo. And that is what's causing this world to become so exciting and so real so fast. And it's why it's so important to lean in.
You used a keyword there, magic. And yeah. I've always loved that phrase that sufficiently advanced technology should feel like magic. One challenge, and it's pretty extraordinary that something's happened that's caused me to complain about this, is that when we talk to potential partners or just, you know, key stakeholders at teams in general, they're expecting magic now because of what OpenAI and associated technologies can do. Can you break down really what are our recent technologies very good at and what are they still working on that they fall short on?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think managing expectations is always beyond critical, especially in the arena of magic, right? Because, you know, your imagination can go in so many different directions because these tools are so powerful and magical, right? So, you know, like a balloon, they can inflate and then fly away. And then, you know, where's the balloon go? Who knows? Depends on which way the wind blows. So I think what you have to kind of really just step back and think about is where can you crawl, walk, and run, right? What do your current workflows look like that have the highest probability of being impacted by this type of technology and the lowest risk factor that you're going to have to mitigate, right? So get small, quickish wins and feel the impact in a measurable, quantifiable way, right? So you can answer Elon's question of what'd you get done this week with an actual answer, right? Of hard data and performance improvement, and then build from there, right? So you just got to be careful not to get all crazy and excited about the buffet and just go fill up your plate and not be able to finish it. You got to start with an appetizer that's appropriate and then scale from there behind it.
Yeah, that's great advice. So Alec, let's get into more specifics around that, because I think that's really helpful advice. But when I look at this image generation, there's obviously text analysis to produce more text. Mm-hmm. I've seen some technologies that are producing like pitch decks, which will change everything for founders. That's really exciting. What about tabular data? Where is that going in terms of how we can evaluate and work with tabular data?
I think I sent you something on this, right, where Steve Jobs was getting filleted, you know, in 1999 mm-hmm. around, right, that question of, you know, how do we use this technology and da 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 da. And he was like, hey, that's kind of the wrong way to think about it, right? All due respect, we start with the customer experience and we move back, right? And so I think when it comes to specific use cases, whether it be, you know, that involve tabular data or otherwise, I think where you really want to go is start with who is the individual or individuals or department within, let's say, a professional sports organization that is or isn't most reliant upon tabular data or otherwise? And equally as important, stepping further back, what is it that they're really trying to achieve? What are they attempting to do? What is the jobs to be done? And then you start thinking about, right, what is the workflow associated with that area of interest and what's appropriate to enhance versus reinvent and what isn't? What's a stretch goal that you want to kind of punt down the road versus just kind of, you know, trying to apply, you know, hammer looking for nails type stuff, right? I like to speak in a lot of these different, you know, kind of cliches and, you know, jargon stuff in part because it's true, right? So I think the first step is trying to understand what exactly are we trying to achieve? What is the job to be done or jobs to be done? Who is involved and who benefits? And what level of comfort do they have with generative AI as it relates to the way they're currently doing whatever it is they're doing versus what they could be doing? And what's the risk profile of doing it differently?
What are you observing in broader fields and what's your advice for people in the sports world in terms of shifting those jobs to be done where, let's say today, a stakeholder has a question and they ask a data scientist and the data scientist takes as long as they take to get an answer back, which, hey, that's a great step from when teams didn't have data scientists. But I think everyone involved in that interaction would admit that it would be better if the stakeholder could ask the question and get an answer themselves, while the data scientists focus on more complex and sophisticated tasks. So what have you observed in other industries and what's your advice for folks in sports looking to shift that way of working?
Yeah, it's a great question and it's a lot to it. But I think the most important thing you can do, if and when you can do it, is to establish a shared understanding and language that everyone can rally around and communicate more effectively in relation to the challenge and opportunity. And at the risk of being disrespectful, I have seen way too many movies where one group, right, a la the deeply technical, so data science team, you know, yada, 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 communicates in a way that is really impressive and great if, you know, that's your native language. But if you don't speak that language and you're a business stakeholder or, you know, you're in the GM's office or what have you, other side of the building or, you know, maybe the same side of the building, but, you know, different kind of languages, you know, sometimes you're just talking past each other, right? Or unfortunately, ego gets involved, right? And one group doesn't want to, you know, reveal that they don't understand something that perhaps they think that they're expected to understand and so on and so forth. And so what you need is an intermediary that can step in, and that can be a human, it can be a technology, it can be a lot of different things, but some dimension of shared codified language around the moving parts, including workflow, et cetera. And that unlocks the ability for genuine progress and the ability to move forward and improve performance and get the results out of the magic, as opposed to some of the friction that unfortunately exists when you're trying to move forward with something as powerful as what, you know, generative AI is. So to answer your question, I think that if I could do one thing, the one thing I would do is generate a shared language amongst diverse stakeholders who have different dimensions of comfort with deep tech and business strategy and other things, and then move from there. Because once you've got that, you're speaking, you know, you're on the same team, you got the same language, you're good to go. But if one group's speaking one language versus another, you know, I think we all know how that movie goes and I see it every day, you know.
Codifying terminology and nomenclature is one of the hardest things we've done in this business, actually. Just what do we call a feature? What do we call a capability? It's really interesting that you start there.
Because if I say to you, we've talked about this, right? Plato theory of forms, here comes the classics, philosophy, education, right? Like if I say chair, you know what a chair is, right? But if I said something that you didn't understand, you know, and I assume that you do, and maybe you assume that you understood something that's different than what I said, how am I going to build upon that idea without eventually the wheels coming off, right? And the answer is I'm not. And that's why it's like, you got to establish that fundamental language for everybody and then go from there.
Let's shift a little bit to what is being built. So I see capabilities. I see just models themselves as something to leverage. And I see applications. I think, you know, selfishly, this is an interesting way to frame explaining and understanding things, because I'm excited and proud at how we are built on top of Snowflake, Databricks, and DataRobot. But some look at that as a little bit of a shortcut. And I want to say, of course, right? Snowflake was the biggest IPO in software history. They wouldn't exist without Amazon Web Services. That's just the way that technology has been built for a long time, because there's so many platforms and there's so many foundation and building blocks that applications get built on top of. So maybe you could help the audience understand kind of the differences there in technologies that are out there. And then I'd love to hear maybe name names, a couple of applications that you're excited about.
It's an interesting topic, right? Because here comes the, you know, how do we calibrate what we're about to talk about for the appropriate, you know, audience or segments of audience, right? So if a CTO or a CIO or anyone in that camp is listening, my answer would probably not be all that interesting to him or her, right? Because they're like, yeah, of course we know that. Now, if some other folks are listening, right, and they have a less sophisticated understanding of all this stuff, I think the way to think about it is to think about the technology in terms of parallels to building a house, right? So you got to make sure that first and foremost, you buy some land that's in a pretty good spot, right? It's durable, it's reliable, and it's battle tested potentially, right? You know, meaning it's not going to, your house is going to fall off a cliff. But then simultaneously, then you start thinking about what do you want to build on top of it and what type of materials are you going to use, right? So why reinvent something that already exists, especially in light of what you can build and the machines can build for you, that no longer require some of what used to be thought of as custom code, right? And so how do you make sure that you're embracing the most modern technical infrastructure while simultaneously applying your resources, to your point, I think where you're going with this, to the highest impact areas of customization and focus, right? So that you build something that's highly differentiated, but you invest, you know, every quote unquote dollar and or hour and unit of bandwidth into where you're going to have the most impact, right? You don't need to build something that competes with the players you just mentioned when you can just leverage, you know, what they're really good at and complement, enhance, right? I think it's really difficult sometimes for non-technical, you know, senior people to be able to distinguish, you know, what is it that we're endeavoring to do and how do we do it in relation to what's already built versus what we need to build ourselves versus what's new and exciting that's as a result of the existing infrastructure, like legacy tech versus, you know, everyone described the evolution of this stuff. It's a very, very complex answer to a very good, simple question. But I think this is where it's really important, again, to have that codified language so everyone's speaking the same, you know, kind of framework of ideas, so that people don't get confused. So it's a long way of saying, I think it's a balancing act and it's really important. And it's, you know, you had to be very deliberate about that stuff because you don't want to bet on legacy tech in areas where you shouldn't. Yet simultaneously, you don't want to bet on building on your home on a cliff in Malibu, you know, ahead of a monsoon that you don't see coming, you know, 6 months down the road that wipes you out.
It's a great way to frame it. And you've raised an interesting topic that I've always found exciting. And that's data sharing and model training. I saw a cool announcement from two brands I really respect, one of whom is a partner, Databricks and Hugging Face, yesterday about a large language model that they've made available to mutual customers that they're partnering on. And it reminded me of something that I'm enthusiastic about, and that's just training models with data from different partners that overlap, that want to maintain privacy, but want to benefit from one another working with a mutual vendor. I just see that being much more prevalent in mainstream fields and banking, in really any kind of mainstream business field. And I know that sports are understandably territorial about their own data and data privacy. It's obviously extremely important, but it's important in many other fields that are collaborating. Can you talk about how some of the evolutions of this type of technology has made certain fields more open about training key models that everyone wants to leverage with data that is private and remains private?
Yeah, there's a lot there, right? That's a very important topic. I think where I would start is if you think about the relationship between a business, its key stakeholders, including, you know, customers, consumers, what have you, you know, ball players, athletes, et cetera, the data that a company or an entity cultivates around its relationship with its key stakeholders is wildly important. And the reason for that is it's obviously one of the most important sources and levers to create value for those stakeholders. And at the end of the day, it's pretty much what businesses are in business, you know, to do, which is create value. And so you have to balance, right, proprietary data, where it lives and exists, how it can potentially be assessed to identify gaps that then could be enhanced, the role of synthetic data, for example, and how and when and where that data set can potentially be, I don't like the word, but exposed to potentially other data sets and or models and other mechanisms that can make it more useful to the entity and to the stakeholders, but to do so in a way that mitigates risk, right? So translation, as anyone knows, if they follow me on Twitter, LinkedIn, what have you, is I'm 100% about humans plus machines, not versus machines, and competing on consumer experience and customer experience, right? So reducing all the friction and making everything better based on bringing all the data to bear, enhancing the experience, whatever the experience might be. And I think that there's so much magic inside of that arena, which is part of the reason why I've been so excited about, you know, being a part of this space for the, you know, as many years as I have. But there's a lot to unpack there. And I don't think I answered your question very well. And I think there was a follow-on question on the back of it. But I think it's really, really important to be very deliberate about when, where, and how you assess and enrich and enhance and apply your proprietary data set to create new value for your organization and key stakeholders, but in a way that is first and foremost, you know, risk profile appropriate, right? Human in the loop comes up, all sorts of stuff. Just you really want to be careful with this stuff because, yeah, things are moving really fast and the pace with which a miscalculation on a risk, you know, dimension can impact you is that's the scary side of the exciting bit of the magic.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, what I'd love to double click on is just if I'm a stakeholder, why should I participate in models that are collaborative and allowing my data to be used to train models? And to underline here at the moment, you know, the Gemini application is only providing, you know, a new and unique model for every project that the user runs. So that's totally siloed and there's multiple redundancies in the architecture to protect the data, obviously. But, you know, we get a lot of teams asking, hey, are we going to benefit from other partners? Are we going to, you know, is each MBA team going to have a better and better and better draft model to access when there are multiple MBA teams using the application? That is actually something a team's ask us about. And we don't do that yet because I've wanted to, you know, establish a beachhead and earn trust before that's something that we explore. But every day I'm reading about different models that are popular, that are effective, that big businesses are allowing their data to be used to train because they know that they're going to benefit as it comes back, as it's reciprocated.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of philosophical stuff in there, right? But let's use the NBA, you know, example. You know, the question obviously starts with what's quote unquote in it for me, right? So I'm a New York guy, so I'll speak from the profile of the New York Knicks, right? the New York Knicks are competing with every other NBA franchise in every dimension, including who they're going to draft, not draft, right? So using draft as an example is if everyone's operating off of the same data set and using the exact same tools, like One Design and Racing, bringing it back to how we first met, right? The reason One Design Racing is so cool is because in theory, every single dimension, with the exception of the human beings, is all equal. Right. So it's in theory, that's the race, is the team versus the team, as opposed to someone who's got a faster boat or whatever. So when it comes to data and technology and so on and so forth, you have to think about, you know, where's the edge? Right. So how do the Knicks pick off, you know, some sort of insight that perhaps the Celtics don't? And so the Celtics miss on someone they should have drafted, and therefore that person comes to the Knicks, the Knicks draft, you know, that person, and then they you know, they do what they do. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying, I don't know, right? But, you know, if you step back and you think about what's in it for each organization in relation to the greater good, you have to just always keep in mind the, you know, principle of business, right? Which is, you know, how does that business, which the New York Knicks are a business, how do the New York Knicks create more value, you know, from doing something than if they did nothing? And I think that's a team by team decision that needs to be made for all sorts of competitive reasons. I hope that helps answer the question. That's probably not the best answer.
It does, Alec, and you raised an important theme and maybe one for the next chat, which is, there are some technologies that give you a distinct competitive edge, and there are some that not using it gives you a disadvantage. And it is simply a level setter. And I think that that's the case with a lot of AI technologies right now.
Without a doubt, right? And what I would say to that is, you know, there's a Goldman Sachs research report that I think did a really good job at speaking to this. But, you know, look, keeping it simple, right? If you go into the New York Knicks organization and in theory, you know, like an MRI machine, right? You could just instantaneously visualize all of the workflows associated with the day-to-day operations around the draft. Let's just keep it super specific, right? Who's doing what? How many hours are they spending doing this versus that? How, you know, quote unquote, senior are they? And therefore, you know, the impact might be a little bit higher than someone who's a little bit more junior and so on and so forth. If you just enabled that franchise to take 20, 30, 50% of their collective human hours away from tedious, you know, important, but non-urgent and, you know, not the best things for humans to be doing that machines are much better at, so that those humans could find themselves with additional, you know, 10 to 20 to 30 hours a week, right? With a 6-week runway to the draft or whatever the math is. I think that's where you kind of want to start. That is it. That's edge, right? Right there, that's edge. And so if that's the way you get going, that's what you do. The rest of it maybe is building on top of that. But I think keep it simple, right? Just start with, you know, humans are really good at certain things. And if they're doing things that machines are better at, then you probably want to, you know, step back and recalibrate the way you allocate between machines and humans so that the humans can do what we're especially good at and the machines can do what they're really good at, you know?
I love it. Looking out for AI with Alec. Alec Coughlin, thanks for your time today.
Right on. Appreciate it. Likewise.